I speak to you as a native son and an alumnus once. That's been said before I got to it. I'm saving that safe for myself. I was thinking a minute or two ago about this climate. I once traduced it in a poem. But I never should say anything against San Francisco and the West, because one of my dreams is that the California, this university, and California, these colleges out here, should dress the balance with the East. It was always a pride with me that that Mark Twain and Bret Hart and people like that were sort of connected with California. It's always been my pleasure to try to steer young students westward to college, to the universities out here. Everybody seems to head the other way, and I always, you know, impatient with it. And I often get somebody in one of our eastern schools to think he's, to swear to me that he'll go to California, one of the universities out here. And then one of these steerers they have at one of the schools will say, he's Harvard material, or he's Yale material, or he's Princeton material, and spoils my game. I'm here now with literary friends, Wally Stegner, and the Shorers, the Stuarts, and those three names are associated for me with the Jackson Memorial Prize and literary doings out here and the development of the literary thing. Always, you know, the university here has its greatest fame for science. And California has the two great fames, Hollywood and science, the world over. And it's always my longing that it should be come up into literary centers, having its own literary centers out here. San Francisco ought to be one of them. And now this is my chance to say that some newspaper, perversely, made a heading out of my misgivings about the young poets, the beat generation. I had hardly seen the poems, and I had seen enough of them to see that they were miserable. As we say in New England, I added that if it was genuine misery, see, not affected, it was all right with me. If any of them are here or anywhere around, you know, in the slums or wherever they are, I hope this reaches them, because in my friendliness about it. I've lived through, of course, many, many things like this, little movements that you think much might come of, and so seldom anything comes of them. Now, I'm not going to talk to you very long, but in this open daylight, it seems as if I could hardly tell you what my greatest interest in the young people over the country is. It seems as if, looking at all this lightness here and all of you spread around, there couldn't be many who suffered what I suffered from when I was of the college age. I suffered from wondering how convictions are had, how you have them. I saw older people with them, and I saw older people worried because I seemed to have none, and I worried about it a little myself. And it's that kind of youth that seems to be my greatest interest in life. seems as if there couldn't be anybody here like that. Look at this in this light, but I presume it's here. And it's the most genuine, one of the most genuine things in the world. Young people take it two ways. Some of them decide to just have them. Go to join something, join church, join Rotary Club, join something, you know, and have it over with. Just and but there's always someone I've just been meeting them. There are always some around who stay in the pains of it. And I don't know whether I've got out of them myself yet, those pains. But I resolved at some time along to not have them if I didn't have them. See, not to worry about it. And it came to me this way in a figure of speech so often. I thought to myself, I write a poem here, and a poem there, and a poem there, and they need have no connection. They need put together into no special great meaning, large meaning, no generalization, never mind. They'll be like stars coming out at night in the evening, one here, one there, all separate, you know, as it looks. And maybe as the evening darkens, they'll constellate. And they have. Somewhat. Critics tell me now that they put together. See? that's some reward to me. It doesn't end at all, but it's quite a reward. things like, we'll say, matters like this about athletics, and we'll say an intellectuality. I went to a convention once that might have been called together to do away with stadia. See, they called them stadia. They didn't say stadiums, they said stadia. And I was the only person there that stood up for the stadia. And I just happened there. They got me by mistake. And you ought to have seen the coaches around, you know, the athletic coaches. They'd got in there, very unhappy looking, sitting around up in the galleries, you know, and all slouched down. They seemed to wake up to my thought. Now, as I reminded them that the Greek nation, the most brilliant of all in the history, had been so athletic, and had mingled the intellectual with the athletic in all sorts of competitive life, the most competitive nations that ever lived, competitive with each other, so beautifully competitive that they wiped each other out. but it was fine while it lasted. And I always thought the type of the intellectual boy in among them all, a disciple of Socrates, one of these boys that's so intellectual that he got beyond everything, good and evil, you know, all was the same to him. He lived, but transcended it all. I like to think of him as if I knew him personally, Alcee. His name was Alcibiades. And he behaved something awful. Came to a grievous end, but he was, oh dear, way up in all the height of these things. That's the kind of people I've been thrown with all through the educational world. Now I mustn't, this must be brief. Take some of the other things. I have a thing to say here and a thing to say there about athletics. One of the things I say to myself is, I hope they won't be ruined themselves because we need them. And you see what I mean by that. Then my difference between Republican and Democrat. I marched in the Grover Cleveland processions here on Market Street and Coney and all that, I suppose, with a double torch in 1884. I marched in a circle of men in uniform, pulling a fire engine. They had me on the fire engine, but they put a pretty girl up there and decided to let me walk in the middle. And it was all for Grover Cleveland. And the only president I was ever entirely happy about. But I've stayed a Democrat in his honor. But that doesn't solve the whole thing for me. You see, things don't get resolved entirely. I have been a more or less unhappy Democrat since 1896. And that always takes me off into a poem here and a poem there. Take the matter of enterprise, see, and the, what shall I call it, the charity state, you know, free enterprise and the charity state. And you're right in the middle of a campaign like that now out here when I come. Sometimes they call it the welfare state. And I know it here, know it in the East, know it in England. Have known quite intimately the maker of the welfare state in England, Lord Beveridge. Young radical when I knew him, very, very radical, very extreme, and now a lord. And when I said to him, "What are you in the House of Lords for?" Boring from within to destroy the House of Lords. And this man now, comfortable, he didn't mind that at all. He said, me destroy the House of Lords. he said, I have nothing against the House of Lords. It's just that Labour crowd. I've lived now all this balancing up, you know, between the two things, the enterprise, my enterprise, and the charities. I've had some of those. This is one of them. I'm here today. See, always that going on. But it's been a poem here and a poem there. And let them put together as Kenneth Burke wants to. Do you know Kenneth Burke? I've just been seeing him. He's one of the wonderful critics. I see, I know my own first meaning. I know my second meaning. In my ulterior. He knows my third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. Now, before I say some few poems, though, the time's short, I just have a little drink to myself. But you see, that's the kind of confidence, if I radiate anything, the kind of confidence in just being, you know, waiting till this remark and that remark, this insight and that insight, all separate, don't worry about them, as the time darkens, as your life darkens, you know, they constellate. They make figures, and then you got convictions. That's all of that. Now, all that's in the poems too. That kind of interest, and not giving it up anywhere. You know, that's the great bravery, just to wait, to give it time, and don't just give it up and climb in. Let it solve itself, you know, a lot. It's up to whom to solve it. And Then when it comes to symbols in it all, I've been saying lately, I've found myself in a kind of symbolism that I hadn't noticed all these years. I'm very fond of the symbol, apparently, of what might be the symbol of all symbols, the couplet. The couplet, rhymed couplet. But that's a symbol, isn't it, of all things like that. The way things come together. They separate and come together, separate and come together. I was thinking that someone says, how about the amoeba? Seems very singular creature. And I said, well, while you're looking at it, it looks ever so single and one, it's probably troubled inside with becoming two. Needs a psychiatrist. It's beginning to divide. All these things, all these quips are like poems, you see, the little quips you make like that. They're all taught this, they're all separate. Let them look ever so inconsistent, too. Somebody introduced me in New York the other night as if I was all just made out of contradictions. That wouldn't worry me. But these things look ever so different. Many a thing looks like what you call, many a pair of things look like a standoff, see? Can't do anything with them, they just stand off. Well, let them stand off. Okay? What will come of it will. I'm tempted to talk to you more than I should. Take the matter of a person like Brutus. You have Brutus in Caesar's play. I mean in Shakespeare's play, Julius Caesar. And you have him in Plutarch's Lives. And he's quite a nobility. He's the hero. He's the heroic republican that we only have a few of left. He was getting pretty scarce then too. There he is, a great figure in those two. And then most of you perhaps have read deep enough into Dante to know that he's in the deepest hell as one of the three worst people that ever lived, being mumbled forever in the mouth of a monster. Now what are you going to do with that? That's Shakespeare against Dante. Standoff. I delight in them, I think. I like to be up to leave them standing. You know, I'm like a dog that has a number of bones around different parts of the yard. And he goes and gets one and worries it for a while, and then he covers it up a little and goes and worries another one. I worry these different subjects a little bit now, once in a while. Get a poem out of them. Poem here, poem there, all that. Now for a few of the poems. And what you'll notice is my special pleasure is often yours in a just little rhyme couplet. Here's San Francisco, where I was brought up to the Chinese question. They were saying when I was young, the Chinese must go, for Kearney says so. They didn't say Kearney, they said Kearney. The Chinese must go, for Kearney says so. He was a sandlot orator. The whole question of Asia, and Asia is being trampled on by us and by the British and all that, that question is always one of those standoffs. And in the rhyme couplet I say about, I have the ghost of Columbus getting loose through the canal at last to go to Europe, go to Asia, where he wanted to go all his life. That's all he wanted. He didn't want to find a new world at all. He wanted Asia. And I let him loose. And then I say, he will be starting pretty late. He'll find that Asiatic state is about tired of being looted while having its beliefs disputed. See, that was a triumph of rhyming and a triumph of my thinking. They're about tired of being looted while having their beliefs disputed. That covers the whole thing for me. And how did they get into that predicament? No, that's another story, we won't go into that. But it's the couplet where I arrive, you see, for myself. You see, this is a certain, something. In another place, I'll show you. I'll say a poem, and you see me arrive at a couplet in it that I especially like. You can tell I do, maybe. I don't know. Sometimes I just write them in, as a pair, just leave them right out in the open. Sometimes they occur right as I go in a poem, like an like a little metaphor or something. This one is about a dog. Take something a little longer first for you. I opened the door so my last look should be taken outside a house and book. Now, this is the only footnote that I always do that. Night, last thing, open the door to get out of the books and get out of the house for a little while, half an hour or so. I opened the door so my last look should be taken outside a house and book. Before I gave up seeing and slept, I said I would see how Sirius kept his watchdog eye on what remained to be gone into, if not explained. But scarcely was my door ajar when past the leg I thrust for bar, pushed in to be my problem guest, not a heavenly dog made manifest, but an earthly dog of the carriage breed, who, having failed of the modern speed, now asked asylum, and I was stirred to be the one so dog preferred. He dumped himself like a bag of bones. He sighed himself a couple of groans, and head to tail then firmly curled, like swearing off on the traffic world. I set him water, I set him food. He rolled an eye with gratitude, or merely manners it may have been, but never so much as lifted chin. His hard tail loudly smacked the floor as if beseeching me, please, no more. I can't explain, tonight at least. His brow was perceptibly trouble-creased. So I spoke in terms of adoption thus, Gusty old boy, Dalmatian Gus, you're right, there's nothing to discuss. Don't try to tell me what's in your mind, the sorrow of having been left behind or the sorrow of having run away. All that can wait for the light of day. Meanwhile, feel obligation free. Nobody has to confide in me. It's because I'm not a psychiatrist. Twas too one-sided a dialogue, and I wasn't sure I was talking dog. You notice? See how pleased I am with that. Twas too one-sided a dialogue, and I wasn't sure I was talking dog. I gave up, baffled, but all the same, in fancy, I ratified his name, Gusty, Dalmatian Gus, that is, and started shaping my life to his, sharing his miles of exercise and finding him and his dog supplies. Next morning, the minute I was about, he was at the door to be let out with an air that said, I have paid my call. You mustn't feel hurt if now I'm all for getting back somewhere or further on. I opened the door and he was gone. I was to taste in little the grief that comes of dogless lives being so brief, only a fraction of ours at most. He might have been the dream of a ghost, in spite of the way his tail had smacked my floor so hard and matter of fact. And things have been going so strangely since, I wouldn't be too hard to convince, I might even claim he was serious. Think of presuming to call him Gus. The star itself, heaven's brightest star, not a meteorite, but an avatar, who had made this overnight descent to show by deeds he didn't resent my having depended on him so long and yet done nothing about it in song. A symbol was all he could hope to convey, an intimation, a shot of ray, a meaning I was supposed to seek and finding wasn't supposed to speak. I don't have too many longs. It's just, now take a couplet or two that by themselves, see the fun I have in them. This is a lot about general religiousness through our life, you know, I say this, forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. And these critics, some of them, have decided that my specialty is tools, farm tools. But I had to be told that. I didn't set out to specialize in farm tools. But I know the difference between a rake and a hoe anyway. See, I don't know, I depend on other people too, if they're gonna appreciate my poems, they gotta know the difference between a rake and a hoe. But it's come up lately, the saying, you know, that weapons should be turned into tools, right up here in the cyclotron. Never happens. Men never discover anything of the weapon nature, you know, the menacing nature, but that they wish it could be made, you know, made it useful in domestic science or something, you know. Always the same talk, you know, you can hear it right on. That's one of the livest questions in the USA today, in the world, about how we can domesticate this terrible thing. And so the Bible has it, the old expression. And I've been thrown with some friends who wanted me to see the lump of iron they have in the basement of the UN. They want me to decide, I think, what it symbolized. They hope I'll do it in verse, maybe I will. But it's a lump of the purest iron, a gift of the King of Sweden. And it's in the meditation room. It looks as if it was a sort of a, oh, I don't know, it looks a little bit like idolatry to me, but it's iron anyway. And they don't want it to be considered idolatry. But I know what they think. They think it's just one thing. But of course it isn't. A lump of iron is at once tools and weapons. You can't look at it without thinking of that. You're in trouble right away. The same thing. And so I made them a couplet like this that they haven't decided to put in the meditation room. But it just like this, it's a sincere one of mine. It says, nature within her inmost self. See, in the purest element you can get, nature within her inmost self divides to trouble men with having to take sides. And some of you are on the side of weapons and some of you are on the side of tools. And I'm on both sides at once, I guess. I'm straddling on that question right now, letting something settle that. But you see, there's the couplet again, settling it for me. And now another problem that always comes up in the literary world about a new writer, a new poet, and something about his style or his way of carrying on, you know, makes him look like a great mystery for a while. That I've lived through that, seen Browning, you know, come on, so they had to have societies to study his poems. Those are gone by now. Everybody takes to Brian as an old, takes him as an old story. But that's gone on. No need of coming down the years. And so I say this in education. It takes all kinds of it takes all kinds of in and outdoor schooling to get adapted to my kind of fooling. That's all the poetry is. It's my poetry is my kind of fooling. And you have to make a distinction, you know, about the difference between being flippant and trivial. Right? You can be flippant and deep, and you can be as trivial as you want to be, for all of me. That's not a matter. Now the time is so short. I have to say, just get away from this talk that I can't seem to leave. Say another poem, one or two short ones. This is one or two little ones. Whose woods these are, I seem to know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sound's the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep, miles to go before I sleep. And another one called Desert Places. Snow, a good deal of snow in mine. I'm a specialist in tools and snow. Snow falling and night falling, fast, oh fast, in a field I looked into going past, and the ground almost covered smooth in snow, but a few weeds and stubble showing last. The woods around it have it, it is theirs. All animals are smothered in their lairs. I am too absent spirited to come. The loneliness includes me unawares. And lonely as it is, that loneliness will be more lonely ere it will be less. A blanker whiteness of benighted snow with no expression, nothing to express. They cannot scare me with their empty places between stars, on stars where no human race is. I have it in me so much nearer home to scare myself with my own desert places. See, that goes internal all of a sudden. And then just again, something for the fun of it, you know, true sonnet goes to 8 lines to a punctuation mark and then goes 6 lines more. And that's called a true sonnet. And I say a truer one would be to go 8 lines to the punctuation mark and then take a turn for the better or worse and go 6 lines. And this one does that. It's about science. Sarcastic science, she would like to know in her complacent ministry of fear, how we propose to get away from here when she has made things, how so we have to go or be wiped out. Will she be asked to show us how by rocket we may hope to steer to some star off there, say a half light year, through temperature of absolute zero? 8 lines. See? Why wait for science to supply the how when any amateur can tell it now? The way to go away should be the same as 50 billion years ago we came. If anyone remembers how that was, I have a theory, but it hardly does. Then another one that goes a little with that, just for the fun of it, so short. I could be more serious there, but let's be lightsome in all this sun's coming out. Or shall I say the San Francisco one, where I traduce San Francisco? This is a memory of it, when everybody was flying kites. And kites were hung on all the telephone, all the telegraph wires. I think there were no telephones. But all kites were all strung everywhere. We were all kite flyers, grown-up men, little boys, everybody flying kites. And the dust was of the sand dunes was always blowing around, and the fog coming up over everything. So I described it this way. Dust always blowing about the town, except when sea fog laid it down. And I was one of the children told some of the blowing dust was gold. So I ought to tell you before I begin that when I got east, I was told that dirt didn't matter. You know, you drop a slice of bread butter side down, and you picked it up and said philosophically, we all must eat our peck of dirt. You see, that was the regular way I was brought up after I got east. But it was different in San Francisco, this leaf. Dust always blowing about the town, except when sea fog laid it down. And I was one of the children told some of the dust, blowing dust, was gold. All the dust the wind blew high appeared like gold in the sunset sky. But I was one of the children told some of the dust was really gold. Such was life in the Golden Gate. Gold dusted all we drank and ate. And I was one of the children told we all must eat our peck of gold. Speaking of gold, I seem to have some here. Is this what I get for coming here, I wonder? I didn't notice that. You see how figurative that can be made. I can do that without anybody's help. When anybody says to me, as somebody said within 48 hours, you make a living out of poetry, don't you? I don't know whether that was meant for an accusation or a compliment, you know, but you make a living out of poetry. I said, we all must eat our peck of gold in a dreary way, you see. I said it just as dreary as I can. You see, that's what you mean by the next meaning beyond. You can do that all the time. That's the fun of it. Let's see what else. The other one. A theory, if you hold it hard enough and long enough, gets rated as a creed, such as that flesh is something we can slough so that the mind can be entirely free. See, this is all getting rid of a stadia too, you know. Then when the arms and legs have atrophied and brain is all that's left of mortal stuff, we can lie on the sea beach with the seaweed and take our daily tide baths, smooth and rough. There once we lay as blobs of jellyfish at evolution's opposite extreme, but now as blobs of brain we lie and dream with only one vestigial creature wish. Oh, may the tide be soon enough at high to keep our abstract verse from getting dry. Then I'm just going to say this without comment. It has to do with the naming of my next book. And it'll be the core of my next book. And you will want to see it. But I'm just going to say it to sort of close the meeting. Let's see. I better be sure to get it right, because it's new enough for that. The pulpiteers still censure our godless adventure into the material since we took that fall from the apple tree, you know. Now this goes on. But God's own descent, this is what I want you to notice, but God's own descent into flesh was meant as a demonstration that the supreme merit lay in risking spirit in substantiation. That's the heart of our religion, and the thing is about materialism and how you, and to make a distinction, just two words about it, to make a distinction between materialism, where the spirit is lost, and materiality, where the spirit has made the adventure and been kept with meaning, see. That's what the book, the heart of the book is going to be about. God's own descent into flesh was meant as a demonstration that the supreme merit lay in risking spirit, in substantiation. I have to substantiate my claim to being here, you see. We all have to substantiate. And the thing is, did I have time enough to assert my spirit that I come to? Just one, I say one more to you. Don't bother to sit down. if you stand there for just a few minutes, I'll say birches to you. And that's about, if I wanted to say the second meaning first, that's about drawing off, to think it over. Drawing off, you know, in a campaign you might draw off, you know, not be beaten, but draw off until you get yourself right again to attack. But draw off between fights and things. And this is about that, really. You wouldn't know it's about woods and trees. This is how they've driven me to this through the years. When I see birch trees, when I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many-colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust. Such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, though once they're bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterward, trailing their leaves on the ground, like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have had some boy bend them as he went out or in to fetch the cows, some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one, he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung limp, not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon, so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. Then he flung outward feet worth first with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches, and so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from Earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. Goodbye.